It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Jen.
I'm Natalie.
I'm Ginny, and we are the Art History Babes.
Together once again for spooky season.
Ooh. Our favorite season.
We're together on a very chilly, spooky autumn night. Just kidding. It's like fucking 80 degrees.
It is. Like 80 degrees.
Sweating on my way over here
too.
In the car in this black shirt. I was like, God damn it.
And your leather shorts.
They're so cool. Basically, Nat came in looking like a fucking cool person.
Nat walked into this house wearing like this oversized black shirt with like gold chains and like leather shorts and leather boots. And I was like, where's your motorcycle?
Yeah.
Where's your boyfriend named Gus?
Butch. Oh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Gus.
I don't know.
I like Gus the best.
I like Gus too. Anyway, you look great and thanks. I'm just jealous.
Yeah, I'm wearing like 75% leather pants.
That's awesome. Without the pants. Because it's warm too.
It is.
Anyway,
warmer than I expected.
Climate change is very real, and we're fine, I guess. We're still here.
You know. For now, we're fine.
Yeah. You know. But I hope everyone's having a super fun, super awesome Halloween season. And today we're going to just talk about some good old fashioned spooky stuff.
Yeah.
We were like, what should we do? What should we do this year?
Because we've covered many, many like Halloween adjacent, Halloween thematic topics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, haunted paintings, witches, the dev,
like art and murder, etc., etc.
What is left? And then we were like, well, there's always more to uncover.
Yeah, we got to thinking about some just regular ass monsters, and a big part of our whole shtick here with the Art History Babes is that visual culture is huge. And so
it's huge.
It's humongous. It's everything. And so we were thinking about just some archetypal monsters that we see in our popular media.
They're like the basic bitches of monsters.
Truly.
Mm-hmm.
Truly.
That's what we're going to be touching on today.
Yeah.
Oh, but you know who I'm realizing we didn't include?
Werewolves.
Which we can.
Yeah.
Next year.
Yeah.
So originally this episode was going to be zombies, vampires, and werewolves. Oh my. Because I just liked how that sounded. But we decided to do aliens instead because
really, I just decided
Natalie
on my
was
own
like,
and
you know,
everyone else let me.
Natalie was like, werewolves aren't really speaking to me, but I'm thinking about
they
aliens.
Weren't. I don't know. Aliens have been on the brain. There was just something more there.
But there's something that unites them all, which is this uncanny valley. Like, they are all either used to be human or some kind of human-like creature, because with aliens, we don't know what aliens would look like, right?
Right. Yes.
They could look like nothing. They could look like nothing our human brains could ever
conceptualize.
Perceive.
Yeah.
But in our popular retellings of the alien phenomenon, the aliens are usually humanoid creatures.
Yeah.
And this that is very disturbing. And I think that that plays into my fear. I have a huge fear of aliens.
You do?
I am very afraid.
I can't wait to get to this. I didn't know that either.
We're going
to
talk about this. But when I was a little kid and that horrible movie, Mars Signs? Attacks came out.
I don't even remember that one.
Horrible movie.
This was my Jaws. Jaws did this. Jaws and Gremlins fucked me up, man.
Mars Attacks is supposed to be like a funny movie. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it's got those terrible aliens with the like the skull faces. And they have these giant oversized brains that come out of their skulls and these huge...
It actually has an exclamation point at the end of the title.
Yes. And these huge unlidded eyeballs. No. And they're so scary.
I'm looking.
Yeah. Oh, no. Oh, my God. This reminds me of that comedian. There's a comedian who does ventriloquist dummies, mm-hmm. and he has one that kind of looks like this.
I think I know who you're talking about. Yes. I don't remember the name, but yeah. And the worst part is that they go, is the sound that the aliens make. And I was maybe 10 or 11 years old when this movie came out. And so the previews would just play on TV.
Oh, I remember the movie poster. Like, I remember the design of that very vividly.
I used to get so scared. So anyway, that was my big monster as a kid. What was your scary monster when you guys were kids?
This is super random and weird, but the movie Chitty Chitty Bang Bang.
Oh yeah.
The car?
Not the car. Though that was alarming. There was a guy in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang who like kidnapped kids. Like he would trap kids in like a net.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I don't even like my child.
It was like a cage, right?
Yeah.
Like a child cage.
Yeah.
That's like, very scary.
Yeah.
Objectively.
And like my child brain remembers him as being like hunchbacked and like green, but I don't even know if that's like actually accurate.
Let's take it to the Google.
But that really scared me.
Mm-hmm.
Really scared me as a kid. And especially because he was like, taking kids. And I was like, we were all raised in that time of like coming out of the 80s where like before people weren't worried about strangers. And we were that like first, I think like really that first like child generation that was like, okay. He wasn't as bad as actually that's pretty fucking terrifying. Scary.
Let me see.
He was just a man.
No, he looks terrifying. That's a horrible man.
Horrible. Horrible.
It's a horrible man.
Oh God.
What about you, Nat?
Okay, so I already alluded a little bit, but Jaws fucked me up.
So, that's like,
a little,
deep water.
Yeah, tangential to what we're talking about. And then
that's super fair. And I feel like Jaws, like, not only does that evoke fears of, like, being attacked by a shark, but it's also, like, that very real fear. Like, I have a fear of, like, being in water where I can't see what's underneath me.
Exactly.
That's just like a very inherently eerie thing where you're swimming, you're exposed, you're vulnerable, and you never know what could be just under the surface.
I think it's called like thalassophobia or something.
Thalassophobia. It's real and I have it. And then the other one was Gremlins.
Oh.
Which I watched way too close. Well, too young and too close to getting a Furby. And this is like one of my mom's favorite stories because at the time, I think I was still pretty little, she was very much proud of the fact that like she went and waited outside of Toys R Us, like the
to get you a Furby.
Yes.
Aww.
Like waited
and you were scared of it.
And then I got it and was fucking terrified of it. And I had like watched Gremlins with my cousin on my dad's side of the family, and then my poor mom was like, well, fuck me, like I got you this gift you really wanted and now you hate it.
I was scared of my Furby when I was a kid too. That shit would talk in the middle of the night.
I would put you'd put a hat over it so because it had the sensors.
Yeah,
so you'd have to make sure it like was off, and to do that you'd have to block its little
I was scared
ads. Yeah,
oh boy.
Oof.
Yeah. I mean, childhood fears are real. And but the I don't know, we'll talk about it, but
that
aliens
could be our next episode.
Yeah. Aliens never left me though. Like I'm still like, oh, like when I think about getting abducted.
Yeah, man.
The common these monsters that threaten bodily harm, all of them. So I guess Well, let's get started.
Let's do that.
Oh my gosh.
I'm excited to get into this.
Zombie. listen to that song. I've got a lot of songs in me today.
Oh, that's a real song?
It is.
That's a real song. By, the Cranberries.
Yeah, it's like about the IRA in Ireland, like in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And the music video is haunting.
Yeah.
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 Zombies.
maybe we'll do a Spotify playlist based on this episode.
We should
include
that song. Yeah,
and also just like the random songs that I've been
exactly.
Just I'm like a parrot. I'm just like singing songs.
You are, and it's sounds. Like a shuffle, just like boom, boom, one to the next. Who knows where the point of origin is? But
nobody
we love it.
Nobody knows. Yeah, I've been thinking about zombies. And so today we're going to get a little bit into the history of the zombie as a monster, as this mythological being. Okay, so the zombie is a mythological, undead, corporeal revenant created through the reanimation of a corpse. So that is all horrifying. The idea that you can bring the dead back to life, and not only are they alive again, but they're essentially slaves. They're like under the control of whoever brought them back, and usually they mean to inflict harm. So the term zombie traces its roots back to Haitian rural folklore and the voodoo religion. And so in this folklore, zombies functioned in this religious narrative as the product of dark magic. And so zombies, originally, the Haitian zombies, where this term originates, were not these violent, kind of ravenous flesh eaters. They were slaves. So the dead person would be physically revived through an act of necromancy by a bokor, which is a sorcerer or witch, and the zombie remains under the control of the bokor as a personal slave. And so it has no will of its own. And so like this zombie myth was used actually in Haitian slave plantations to keep the slaves afraid of potentially any uprisings or anything, because the fear was that if they died in said uprising, they would anger some kind of god that would then leave them vulnerable to being resuscitated as a zombie who would then have to continue to do hard labor as
that
a slave.
Is so screwed.
Isn't that horrible?
That's like, it's like flipping the whole heaven hell narrative again.
Yeah.
To meet your purposes.
Exactly. And so this is not a shock, right? If you consider the origins of Haitian culture, the marriage of West African religious practices and Catholic icons mixed with the slavery, the colonialism, and ultimately revolution of the Haitian peoples, who we won't get into it, but the Haitian revolt is probably the most successful slave revolt in history. And the country of Haiti has never ceased to be punished for that revolt today. So that's a whole thing. It's really sad. But the Haitian voodoo zombie is associated with enslavement. And so that is the idea of returning to enslavement is a terrifying concept for a society that was founded on the overthrow of colonial rule. And so this figure of the Haitian zombie first attracted, this is interesting, widespread international attention during the United States occupation of Haiti, which was from 1915 to 1934. And that's when a number of these case histories of purported zombies began to emerge in the United States. Most notably in the work of an author, William Seabrook, his book, The Magic Island of 1929. He wrote a lot of racist shit. about the various voodoo practices that he observed in Haiti, and that included an account of zombies, which he described as these resurrected corpses that would be raised from the dead by a master figure and forced to do enslaved labor. There was this really good movie. It was called like the Serpent, the Rainbow Serpent or something. Damn it. I gotta look it up because there's this really popular zombie movie that is about this whole history. I'm looking it up right now. Zombie movie. History. The Serpent and the Rainbow, directed by Wes Craven. Watch it sometime. But it's interesting that there's a lot of theories about how a zombie can be made. So there's necromancy and just straight up magic. But then there's this, there are reports that people claim have happened where one of these sort of like witches or dark magicians would make a concoction of a variety of different plants and chemicals and things and make a powder that you could then blow onto somebody.
Right.
And essentially turn them into this zombie. And then so the person's all catatonic and then they would bury them in like, you know, like, oh, it's they've been buried, they're dead. But then later they come and bury, they take the body out. The person never actually died. And then they're all kind of catatonic and all fucked up because they got poisoned essentially. And then that is like the zombie. I don't know if that's real, if that's ever been done, but it, anyway, it's in this movie, The Serpent and the Rainbow. Watch it. It's a weird movie. So that's a little bit about the historical zombie. But images of the dead that associated with the living have existed for centuries. So this idea of like dead humans interacting with living humans, like we've had that imagery in our popular culture for millennia. And so in Western art history, this sort of ubiquitous presence of death dominated during the medieval up to, I mean, through the Enlightenment. And not surprisingly, because, you know, 13th century, everyone's dying of plagues.
Everyone was dying.
You know, it was, I think I've heard somewhere that the 13th and 14th century were just like the worst time to live.
Yeah.
As humans.
Worst time to be alive.
Yeah.
In terms of your life expectancy. It's a little cathartic
right now, because I think people like to try and evoke that.
I know, right?
Dude.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But so, I think it was,
it's a good reminder.
Bad.
And like,
then,
you know, we think about like our current plague, and it has lasted much longer than anyone initially would have thought. But like the plagues that were happening in the medieval era, like those would last for years,
years.
So many people died.
And would decimate large
millions of people
not to downplay what we have now, because it is significant, and it is
what we're not downplaying, because we have technological advances that have now helped us to save lives. Just a reminder to people that, we have things now that actually make a difference. But I digress.
Like, but yeah, because like during, you know, like the black, the bubonic plagues, like your best chance of that was like fucking stuffing like roses in your
someone would come in like a big, a bit of mask with a beak,
because they get very scary. And like, terrifying. I'm sorry, but if I am dying, if I'm covered in bubos, I don't want that guy coming in to touch on me. I'm,
because that's what they did. They would they would poke and they would prod.
They would drain the bubos. That's the name
of
the big.
Leave my bubos alone.
Don't touch my bubos.
Unhand my bubos.
Horrible, horrible time to be alive. And so because everyone was just dropping dead all the time, and nobody knew why. Which is, I think that's what makes it especially scarier, is just,
oh, for sure,
no one knew why it was happening.
It's why religion was so popular, is because people needed sorry, I'm gonna upset some people with this,
but it's true.
This went right in.
Well, in some of the earliest examples of pogroms against Jewish people trace back to the Black Death because no one knew why it was happening.
Everyone
so
wants a scapegoat.
Blame it on the Jews, because the Jews were a group that were they were bathing, which
yep.
the average medieval person, Christian, believed that bathing was sinful because it was like you're touching your body. This mm-hmm. is true.
It is.
And so Jews were singled out because they weren't getting the plague as much. And
because
so it
they
was
were hygienic.
Because they were taking a bath.
Yeah.
So it was obviously because of them.
Oh, yikes, guys. This just goes to show.
Well, I mean, I digress. We're not talking about the Black Plague. But what we are talking about is that this rich allegorical language of like death amongst the living really took hold in Western art history in the medieval period. So artists would translate this traumatic experience of just survival during these times into art. And so the Walking Dead rose up as a prominent element in art. So many of these figures were usually portrayed in like religious taboos. So martyrs are the big ones.
Sure, sure.
So martyrs are early Christians who usually died in some horrible way,
truly.
But representing the faith, the Christian faith. And so images of martyrs usually indicate how they were killed. And you could find some kind of symbol of how they were killed on their person. So, for example, like a clergy member who was stoned to death might be depicted with a rock balanced on their head.
Beautiful.
Or like an individual who was stabbed to death might be seen with like a cleaver buried in their skull, such as the case of Saint Peter. Images of Saint Peter usually show him with like a big ass like machete just through the top of his dome. And there's blood and he looks pallid and he looks dead.
He does very much look like a zombie.
But he's, you know, this is from this image right here that we're looking at is from a large altarpiece by Bergognone. I don't know how to say his name.
Bergognone.
There you go. From the Renaissance period. Another popular saint that would have been depicted in a gruesome way was Saint Bartholomew, who was flayed alive. And so images of Saint Bartholomew.
I remember Saint Bart for that. I mean, that's
sure.
memorable.
I mean, oof. Yeah.
Oof. The most famous, I think, being the, what's it called?
Last Judgment.
The Last Judgment.
Michelangelo.
With Michelangelo. Yeah.
Who is it?
So Michelangelo, the myth, I don't know if it's true or not, is that he depicted Saint Bartholomew holding his own flayed flesh, but it's a self-portrait of Michelangelo. So the Apostle Saint Bartholomew here by Matteo di Giovanni. I cannot say
Giovanni.
I'm sorry to our Italian listeners.
No, you're saying it
I
right.
just can't help it. It's too fun. He's shown here holding his flayed skin and he's wearing it like a shawl.
Yes,
like he's wearing
like someone would wear like a little fox.
Yeah. And in the front you can see it's like his foot skin. Mm-hmm. It's really gnarly.
Which though, like I would again like to like draw the parallel to a little like fox
sure.
What are those called?
Stoles.
A stole.
Yeah.
And then a little feet literally hang in the front.
Mm-hmm. This is like an aesthetic painting of this red man because he has no skin.
Right. Because initially it's really not like that jarring when you first look at it.
Sure. You just think he's wearing all red.
Yeah. You're like, oh, he's painted red. Like he's got a red body.
He's a little
okay.
demon.
And then you look closer and it's like, oh. Like he's not all sinewy, you know.
There's some way more brutal ones of
Hell
Saint
yeah,
Bartholomew that I didn't include because I could just talk about Saint Bartholomew for a whole podcast, but
sure,
we got to do like martyrs.
That would be very interesting. Yeah, that would be very interesting.
I think a martyr episode would be really fun because there are so many of them and they died
in
gruesome ways.
And their iconography is really interesting. Like what you were talking about, like, you know, the ways in which they are called out as like, hey, I'm Saint whatever. And like one of them is like, I think it might be Saint Catherine who was like killed on like a wheel, like where she was like put on a wheel and like her iconography is fucking wild. So yeah, we should do that. That'd be dope.
Saint Denis was decapitated and he is depicted usually holding his own head.
Cool.
And the story goes that he was decapitated. He picked up his own head, walked 7 miles and gave a sermon.
Who else was gonna do it?
It's amazing. I mean, he was dedicated. He's like, I got a sermon to be at, and I'm gonna get there.
Got somewhere to be, sermons to give.
We'll do martyrs because
he is. Look at him, just fucking trucking along with his head, just like so get weird. Out of my
and
way.
And that's another one that they have like really brutal paintings of where there's just blood like just coming out of his nub and he's just like, gotta pick up my head. It's crazy.
This would be a good next year maybe we do martyrs.
We'll do martyrs.
Martyrs and movies that fucked us up.
Yes. But aside from images of martyrs, the image of a dead man of animated corpses, that has been with us for a very long time. The Dance of Death is a very popular allegory of it falls into the topic of memento mori. But more than that, it's usually, I think it must have just been fun to make these works and just show like skeletons or decomposing corpses dancing around, usually shown interacting with the living. And the living are not like super stoked to have them around, but are also kind of like, oh, you know, hey, like it's not so bad.
They're here.
So, and then of course, memento mori is something that we talk about a lot on this podcast. And so ways in which memento mori are represented in art sometimes are very subtle. Listen to our memento mori.
Speaking of subtle memento mori.
What do you got there?
Middle school.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Beautiful.
How did I miss that?
I know.
In the pocket.
Oh. Nat has a really cool pin. Little Nat's on her pin game. She got me this like really cool Tom of Finland pin, which is someone you should look up, and I'm really excited about it.
We'll share it all to close friends.
Yeah. Anyway, so memento mori, like I said, sometimes the memento mori, this idea of remembering you will die, it can be very subtle. It can be like rotten fruit on a plate. Mm-hmm. Or in the case of this painting by Giovanni Martinelli, Death Comes to the Banquet Table. It's literally just a skeleton showing up like, hey, dude, it's time to go. Like,
everyone looks horrified.
Everyone's pissed. And honestly, this woman here in the middle is pissed. She's like, what the fuck, dude? Like, we're literally eating pie.
Right.
How dare.
And so that's a little bit about images of death incarnate in some art history. But one thing I really wanted to talk about with zombies is the association of the zombie figure associated with pandemics.
Yes.
And viruses and viral contagion. And so this plays directly into the history of the zombie in especially the United States, because during that United States occupation of Haiti, another really significant thing happened, which was the 1919 Spanish flu pandemic, which is still, I think, one of the worst plagues in human history.
Yeah.
I think it was something like 50 million people died, maybe more. Yeah, 50 to 100 million people died. And millions more infected. So horrible flu. The U.S. lost a ton of people. I think probably more than have died from the COVID-19 pandemic. But we're catching up. So it wasn't an ordinary flu virus. It was notable for killing young adults in high numbers. And it came with super grisly side effects like just massive bleeding from your nose and your mouth and your ears, which is like, oh my God, that's so scary. It would damage your nervous system, your respiratory system. It could cause derangement, delirium. And people who recovered often experienced profound like lethargy, like very just listless and suicidal depression.
Shit.
Which, I mean, they probably looked like zombies.
Yeah, yeah.
So this pandemic was brutal, and what ended up happening, because no one expected the amount of dead people, is that bodies were piling up everywhere. People had, we had to go back to digging pits like in the old plague days. It was really terrible. There's something that happens to the human psyche when you see
so much death,
mass graves, piles of corpses. Like, this is very traumatic.
Yeah.
And so during this time, the zombie starts to take hold in the popular culture of the United States. Notably, H.P. Lovecraft was producing tales filled with corpses and infectious diseases that would result in these sort of lurching, flesh-eating invaders who would kill and leave corpses in their wake. So his most famous story about this was Herbert West Reanimator, which is there's a movie called Reanimator, super classic horror film. It's awesome. Watch it. But Lovecraft makes this character, this terrible doctor who is who wants to reanimate newly dead corpses. And a pandemic arrives, and this offers fresh specimens. And so these scenes of mass graves, piles of bodies. So this doctor has the opportunity to dead bodies and work on his project. And he ends up reanimating the corpse of a doctor who died in a hospital during the outbreak. And he creates a proto-zombie who escapes and wreaks havoc on the town and goes around killing people and is so scary. And
that's
and
a very like Frankenstein's monster
And so it is bad. He shouldn't have done that. There's other stories that Lovecraft did during this time, but there is this sort of prejudice that runs through the zombie tradition, and it's fueled by these fears of contagion, especially during the Spanish flu pandemic. But even before the outbreak, Lovecraft was not like a great person. And he believed that foreigners were infecting the Aryan race. Weakening the bloodlines. He was xenophobic.
Honestly, this kind of tracks with some more recent trends with the pandemic.
Sure.
The idea that people bring in natural selection stuff. It's like,
oh, yeah. And pandemics are just perfect fodder for the xenophobic fears, that's always happens. Yeah. There's always a fear of immigrants, non-white people, racism. Yeah, it's and Lovecraft really was into that. So, you know, eventually the figure of the zombie becomes more of like a fun movie trope. So, people like George Romero. With Night of the Living Dead, one of the first like major zombie movies. There's also White Zombie, which came out in the 1930s and is also one of my favorite bands because I love Rob Zombie.
Sick.
But this notion of a viral zombie, they spread their zombie plague. You become this corpse and it's a virus and you get it from contact with the zombie and then you will become one and real scary stuff.
Very scary.
So coming forward to today, the zombie is actually our most popular monster in popular media. Today, because there's a lot of interesting connections there, but a dissertation by Heather Castro at Temple University. Good job, Heather. I loved reading your dissertation. connects the zombie prominence in popular culture to what she refers to as social trauma in the aughts, basically, like the last two decades. It makes a lot of sense.
It does.
So what have we experienced in the last two decades? 2001, 9/11, horrible. Probably the first time that such a insane tragedy was just on live TV that we all got to watch over and over again. Rampant pandemics. So HIV, which had been happening since the 80s, bird flu, swine flu, all of the H1N1s, etc., Ebola, terrible. All of these have amassed to a death toll of over 2 million, somewhere around 2,475,000 people, or just over 0.03% of the world's population, which is doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot. It's really, really traumatic. And it is then no surprise that these recurring social traumas have caused the image of the zombie to take the forefront of popular media. All we have to look to is things like The Walking Dead and all of our other fun zombie movies. And so, yeah, last here, I just have a couple of images of some zombie figures in more recent artworks. There are a couple of artists who have focused on the zombie in some of their contemporary work and often are depicting these figures as more like sympathetic creatures, like usually in more mundane scenes than, you know, eating brains. Kim Dorland in 2013 paints zombies or the parents, and she paints these two figures that she describes as the parents. So they are staggering through this blood red forest, but they don't really elicit this bloodlust, more of like a connection to nature. They're a bit sympathetic. They look kind of like zombies, but they're also the calling them the parents is kind of this bringing it back to humanity and whose parents are they? Are you being pursued by them? Should you kill them? Also, another artist here who focuses on zombies, Jillian McDonald, took a series of photographs of zombie walks, which I don't know if y'all have heard of these, but it's a relatively new popular thing where participants, not that new, I mean, they've been going on for a while, but participants dress up like zombies and parade around and act like zombies. And so this is another realm where you get to see some sympathetic zombies. So by pretending to be zombies, you can make it kind of humorous and humanizing. And so here we see as a woman in zombie garb, just taking the subway.
As, I like it.
As you would, you know, taking the L train in the middle of your subway commute. So the zombie, just to wrap it up, is this vessel for the displacement of just a lot of fears that we have in contemporary life, contagion and disease. We're all living in it right now. Aging, mortality, environmental disasters, the apocalypse, etc. So we are seeing the zombie in our popular media, maybe because we're comforted and entertained.
Right.
There's like a sense of control in the stories about the zombies. Usually you beat them, you know, usually you end up eliminating them entirely. There's a potential for mitigating these concerns. So the narratives help us get a sense of control over something like an unstoppable plague, like a 28 days later type of situation. So the zombie calms our fears of global pandemics and societal collapse. showing that ultimately these very dangerous creatures, they can be contained and controlled and maybe even cured. So the zombie makes us think about our humanity and what the future might hold. So hopefully we never have a zombie pandemic,
but
you know,
yeah. It says something that that's like such a dominant trope, like in film.
Yeah.
Because it's something that like we're really mindful of. And I don't think that is going anywhere in terms of like the popular culture interest in it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just not, because it's something like we can relate to. Have you guys seen the movie Train to Busan?
Yes. Oh my God.
But that's my favorite zombie movie.
It's so
good. Hands down.
If y'all haven't seen Train to Busan,
fuck.
Nat, you gotta watch it.
What is it?
It's a zombie movie. It's a
South
Korean.
Korean zombie movie. Okay.
Dude, they're killing it, man.
I know. The blowing us out of the water.
South Korea's been putting out.
And it's just
it's
like
really
it's
good.
Scary. It's action packed. It's like surprisingly like very emotional and like poignant. Mm-hmm. Like at the end of it, I was crying. Like,
I cried too.
Crying.
I know. All right. My favorite character was that cool guy. I'm not gonna spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen but cool. I was like, man, he was so cool. Anyway, zombies. God, watch that movie.
Watch it. Should we take a break?
Let's take a little break.
Let's take a break.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
We're back.
We have returned. And from zombies to vampires, which I think is a smooth transition.
Oh, yeah.
Because the two really do have a lot of elements in common.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they both can evoke a lot of the same fears that are innate in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, like, I think vampires are very like symbolically rich monster.
Yes.
They have been believed in since like the beginning of recorded history, and they are believed in like across culture, religion, regions throughout time. And like the belief in these creatures that feed on humans, that feed on humans' blood, flesh, all that is something that is just like very like innate and like animalistic and the kind
hot.
Of yeah.
Gary Oldman.
Oh my God. In that Dracula, when he played Dracula, that movie.
Horny.
I mean, so bad. And Keanu Reeves. Why was Keanu Reeves in that?
God, he was terrible.
He was so bad.
He was like, oh no, I'm getting fucked by all these hot bitches. Oh
my God. And that was like, I feel like that movie came out after like Keanu Reeves was in this like really corny but hilarious movie called Point Break.
Oh, I saw Point Break. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For anyone who doesn't know, it's a movie where he is an FBI agent. He goes undercover to be a surfer because he's infiltrating a group of surfers that are robbing banks. And Patrick Swayze is like the lead guy of the surfer bank robbers.
Great movie.
So he like did that, and I don't think it was like that and then immediately the Dracula movie, but like it was too close, it was too weird. But Gary Oldman was an excellent Dracula.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about some kind of early, more like ancient civilization concepts, beliefs of vampires. And, you know, there are examples of vampires in Mesopotamian civilizations. The Persians depicted vampires who would attack and suck blood from men on, you know, excavated pottery shards. Mm. The Babylonians believed in like a kind of demon goddess called Lilitu, which in Hebrew is Lilith, which Lilith, if you know, was in the Bible Adam's first wife, who was cast out because she was not subservient to Adam. But also, like, in Babylonian and early Hebrew lore, like, Lilith was like this she demon who drank blood and like ate babies, and
we support her either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here for both.
In India, there was the belief in the Waitalas, and there's like Sanskrit folklore about these creatures that were like bat-like and and fed on people, and, you know, were hunted by legendary kings. And it was said that, so Bram Stoker, who wrote Dracula, his family was in India because he was British and, you know, colonizers it be, etc. And it was said that he actually read some of that because it was translated into English. So that could be some early influence for him there.
Nice.
The ancient Greeks also believed in vampires. The goddess Hecate, which is the three-faced witch goddess. We talked about her briefly in our witches episode. She had a daughter named Empusa who was said to seduce men and drink their blood while they slept. So, you know, those are just a few examples of ancient mythology that really believed in creatures, in gods, goddesses, you know, mythological, all kind of powerful beings that fed on humans. So that's just like a thing that we've collectively believed in and been afraid of for centuries and centuries and centuries. And then we go into the medieval times, and as Jen talked about, you know, 13th, 14th century, like, shit was just really bad.
Bad times.
You know, plagues, and people were dying quite a bit. And there came to be this belief in what at the time were called revenants. And revenants were the belief in corpses that became animated, whether it be like they were animated by like some evil spirit or whatever, but the belief that someone who had physically died could then come out of the grave and prey upon the living and feed off of the living.
Scary.
Very scary. A very, very like real fear. And this only got worse. And what's interesting to me, because like when you read about vampire history lore, or you like watch documentaries about it, it kind of branches off in like two main directions. Like the first one is like people talk about that guy Vlad the Impaler, who was like a medieval Transylvanian lord, and he was said to impale his enemies and like feast on their flesh. And he is not like the only like guy from history who was said to like dine on his enemies. Like that in and of itself isn't all that unique, but he was said to be from the house of like dragon, so like Dracul. And
cool,
so like,
because he had a cool name.
It is a cool name. Yeah. It is a cool name. So like you hear about that, and then you hear about like 19th century and like 19th century like obsession with vampires, which I will get to briefly. But what I think is perhaps even more interesting, just in terms of like the time period and kind of like the mentality, is like as you go into the 17th century, because like prior to the 17th century, you know, that's like pre-science, right? So like you don't have people who are actively investigating things and is in the way that we think of science.
Yeah.
You know, it was largely superstition and religious motivated.
Yes.
But as you come into the 17th century, it's this weird kind of confluence of enlightenment, early science, but also still heavily superstitious, especially throughout swaths of Europe, very Christian. And at this period is when people became super afraid of, one, being buried alive, mm-hmm. and two, the dead coming back to life as these like creatures who would then feed on their family members. And as you have things like plagues, like tuberculosis, it was believed that, hey, if your whole family, except for you and like your son, have died of tuberculosis, dig up the rest of your family members and look to see which corpse is still intact, and there's your vampire.
Whoa.
And there were all these firsthand accounts of doctors, investigators, priests who were like, yep, this town, we found some vampires. And you know, at this time too, so early in like kind of the scientific journey of humanity, is that like people really didn't understand the ways in which bodies decomposed or decompose more slowly, rather. Mm-hmm. So like they didn't understand like, okay, if someone dies in the winter, you put them in the coffin, you put them in the ground, mm-hmm. months later they're still gonna look like pretty good, yeah. just because of the way that they're preserved,
right?
Yes. So they would excavate these bodies and they would have like a full head of hair, they'd still have skin on the bones, and they have that belief where, you know, you'd put the stake through the heart. And when they would do that, oftentimes the body would let out a groan, which is very scary.
Objectively terrifying.
But what they didn't know at the time was that even when a body is dead for a long time, it contains a lot of gas. It contains a lot of air. And when you, you know, stab it through the chest, yeah. that's pushing the air out of the body and it lets out a sound.
I don't mm-hmm. like gas right now. Like, I can't even right? imagine.
I mean, I'm going to have gas in my body for a long time after yeah, I'm dead.
I'm full of
a
air.
A long time. So all this fear around the dead, and also that idea of the dead being vehicles of pestilence, of plague, of disease, and the proximity to dead bodies putting you as a living person at risk of your health, that all plays into this idea of vampires. And like in the 17th and even early 18th century, like, the idea of vampires weren't really so much these creatures that would like bite on your neck and suck your blood, but they were more like, okay, your daughter who died of tuberculosis, who then turns into this monster who visits your son at night, and then he gets tuberculosis. And the only way to save your son is to dig up your daughter's body, cut out her heart, and fucking set it on fire.
Whoa.
And then like, give the ashes to your son to put in a tea.
Oh, you know? No, don't drink
you're
that.
Like, you're like, that's really the only option? Like,
there's not like a...
What's plan B?
Budget option?
Yeah. Jesus. Extreme.
Very extreme. And like there were cases of this in America, but it was most predominant in Eastern Europe, which mm-hmm. I think is again where we get this concept of like vampires being mm-hmm. like, ooh, Transylvania.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Ho, ho, ho.
Yeah.
and there's a case of this Serbian peasant named Petar Blagojevich. I'm sorry.
Pretty good.
No, that was... Sounded great to me.
Thanks. He died in 1725 and was said to have become a vampire after death, killing 9 other villagers.
What? What was Peter up to?
People were just saying he would visit them.
Ugh.
And his wife was like, after he died, he visited me and he asked for some shoes and I had to move villages.
Sure. He had to move the whole villages after that.
Damn.
But
he just wanted his shoes.
He just wanted his shoes. He's like, give me my shoes and I'll go.
Yeah.
And then I'll kill 9 people on my way out of town. Yeah. But yeah, so like the 17th and 18th century, like it really... It plays on real fears of death, plague, and disease. The 19th century is where we see the rise of Dracula and the sexy vampire, which is still collectively kind of like within our sort of vampire cultural lexicon that, you know, vampire fiction is still huge.
Twilight's having a huge resurgence right now. I don't get it, but it's happening. Sure. No stopping it.
Oh, that's interesting.
I've got thoughts about the like more contemporary vampire exaltation.
Yeah.
What's up? True Blood? I hate that show.
I think we're just obsessed with anti-aging. That's where we are at socially. At least in the United States, we are obsessed with the idea of anti-aging.
Vampire facials.
I want one. What is that?
They like take your blood out of you and centrifuge it, and then they put it back on your face.
Yeah, literally.
I don't know what it does.
They take it, but I want to do it. They draw your blood. They like spin it around a bit, and then they infuse the hemoglobin back into your skin on your face,
dude. Okay, so
to like build collagen.
Have you guys heard of that? I think she was Hungarian.
I know who you're talking about.
Who like killed hundreds of young women servants and would bathe in their blood.
There are so many more productive ways to not age.
Bathe
in a blue.
Elizabeth Bathory. There we go.
There's a metal band called Bathory.
They should just call that a Bathory facial. That's fucked up.
Bathory. Wow.
Yeah. So she was a Hungarian noblewoman and serial killer. And she was accused of torturing and killing hundreds of girls and women between 1590 and 1610.
That's a long time.
I know, dude.
20 years.
In her punishment, she was like put in a tower that was like bricked up. So like she was passed food through like a little slat.
At least they gave her food.
I know, dude. Man. I was like, that's some like Brothers Grimm shit right there. Like, scary.
20 years of just murdering people and bathing in their blood. And that cannot be an easy process. Like, let's just acknowledge that. Like, draining someone of their blood and then bathing in it and then disposing of that blood.
I know. And she was said to be like a mega beauty, but like, I'm looking at her now and I'm like,
I've seen better.
Let me see this bitch. I mean, she's okay.
Yeah, she's all right. I wouldn't like I would expect something more if you're bathing in blood on the rag. That's a cool picture.
that's nice.
Anyway.
So yeah. But I agree, like vampires nowadays, they're attractive because it's like an anti-aging and
It's like they're frozen in time. It's like, isn't that what we're all after at this point, I guess.
But it's so interesting because like the 19th century is a definite shift in terms of vampires. Before were always scary. I don't think there was anything sexual or alluring about them at all. But like when you look at the 19th century, that was a repressed ass time. True. Like very monitored, very constrained. And so, especially with authors of the time, they would write these stories that they were able to like imbue with sexual themes, but to do it in a way that was like subtle and socially acceptable. And before Bram Stoker's Dracula, there was a book prior to that about a vampire by an Irish author named Sheridan Le Fanu, and it was called Carmilla. And it was a story of a young woman who was preyed upon by a female vampire who was obsessed with her. And it obviously had this not so subtle theme of like lesbian sexuality, but was veiled in this like Victorian kind of way.
That's hot.
Next book club.
And there, you know, like the first print I have here is based off of that story, and it's, and you see like there's so many 19th century prints of vampires, and they're horny. Like they're horny as
fuck. It's horny. There's something, they like come and they They sort of like possess your body.
Yeah.
And like take your essence and
Ooh.
Well, and I mean, let's just talk for a second. Like someone sucking on your neck.
It feels good. I like it.
It's not a bad feeling when you want it. So.
And it's just, it's so symbolically, it's so interesting because like we talked about it, embodies the not aging, and we equate youth to being desirable. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, it's like the whole like neck fixation, and it's also penetration, you know, it's like fangs penetrating into skin. It's the exchange of fluids.
Oh my God.
I mean, it's true.
And, you know, this idea of something that is dangerous and alluring all at once, that is something that is innately attractive to humans.
Yeah.
And I feel like the 19th century is what really got that and really like catapulted that imagery, that association of the vampire. And especially in societies like Victorian England, where, you know, it's very religious, it's very Christian. Mm-hmm. But you have this creature that is like, that in many ways is the Antichrist, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's got bat wings, or he can turn into a bat. Mm-hmm. He sucks your blood, which is, you know, especially if you're looking at Catholicism as a direct kind of act against Catholicism, where you're looking at, like, you know, the wine and the blood and Jesus and all that shit, and you look at the vampire that completely turns that around, that takes your life force out of you.
Mm-hmm. In a very hot way.
Yeah.
I know. I'm aroused. I don't know what to say. I mean, it's just, it's the facts.
But yeah, it's very, like I said at the beginning, like the vampire is a very symbolically rich monster. Mm-hmm. And I just finished watching Midnight Mass on Netflix.
My friend was recommending that to me.
Mm-hmm. And without giving anything away, but like that really gets into those ideas of Catholicism in particular, and blood being this divine essence, and how that can get conflated with a creature who subsists off of blood by feeding on humans, but how that's been transformed into this sexy, mysterious monster that, like, there's so much literature about it. I mean, like, it was funny too, like, in trying to do research on this, like, I would do like generic searches like vampires in art, or like, you know, I tried looking about like, oh, books on like vampires in art history, and like hardly anything popped up. It was all like vampire, like erotic fiction, basically.
Yeah.
But I think it's just a really interesting monster, and I don't think it's going anywhere from like popular culture in the ways that it gets reconceptualized, and a figurehead of like what is scary but what is very alluring.
Oh yeah, I love vampires.
Yeah they're cool.
They're pretty fucking cool.
They're hot.
They are. I mean, we've made them hot. If they weren't hot, we have now fully made them hot.
I'm thinking about like men that I've been attracted to.
Oh my God. It's such a type for you, Jen.
Do you remember that guy?
Yes.
Oh God.
I mean, I'm not sure we're talking about the same
guy. No, we're talking about the same guy. Yeah. I hope you're doing well out there. You know who you are.
Blesses.
If you're listening.
Okay.
Take a break?
Yeah. Sure.
Jumbies, vampires, and jaliens.
Jaliens.
Ooh. Ooh, that was a nice little sound wave.
Aliens. We're back.
We are back.
We've returned.
Here we are. So last piece of our monster puzzle We're talking extraterrestrials. Mm.
So scary.
Yeah. I think we're getting to a place where the term alien is starting to become not politically correct.
Word? Because of immigrants? Is that...
I don't know.
Am I being problematic?
Wait.
Hold on.
If you are, we'll cut it out.
Pause. Cut.
I don't know. I had that same thought. And I don't know if that is the reason. The origin of this is Demi Lovato's new show.
Oh, I've heard of this.
Which I haven't seen because I don't have Peacock.
I don't either, but I've heard some of the things that she's talking about.
Yes, one of them is, yes, the nomenclature.
Sure.
And so I don't know. I'm going to use the term for this episode.
That's fine.
I hope I don't offend anyone.
You know what? If you want to write us an email being offended about the word alien, go for it.
I just...
You know,
pronunciations are hard for me. Committing to saying extraterrestrial every time
that's a mouthful
alien is not going to work for me. It's just not.
You guys know what we're talking about. So
I mean it endearingly.
I can't believe that this is. I know. Why are we doing this right now? I can't believe this is happening.
I'm kind of doing it facetiously a little bit, but apparently that is like a real thing.
Wow.
And I was interested in watching Demi Lovato's docuseries, so I'm not hating on it. I was actually going to watch it until I realized I had to sign up for a trial and do all of that.
Pain.
And just, it wasn't going to work.
Pain.
But, there's plenty of content out there.
Yes, there
on
is.
This topic.
If you have Hulu, you can have access to all 14 seasons of Ancient Aliens.
Hulu, HBO, Amazon Prime.
It's on all those?
Netflix.
I think it's on everything.
Well, I'm just listing all the things that I got different alien docuseries from.
Damn, dude.
Yes.
I watch alien shit like constantly. It's on everything.
I do not. So there was a lot for me to catch up on because this is not my regular source of entertainment. But I quickly slipped in and, you know, assumed the role for this.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
So aliens, I think the major thing definitely overlaps with the theme of fear.
Yes.
With fear being the like undercurrent of why people give a shit about aliens. Mm-hmm. Add on conspiracy theories, because when it comes to aliens, I think we're at a place where we can all agree that, like, we're not alone. Like, it just statistically does not make sense.
Yeah.
Right. Yada, yada, yada.
Disclosure happened. And everyone was like, whatever.
Right? Because we had all, like, it was old news by then.
Yeah,
like
okay, the Pentagon.
In the midst of, like, a bunch of other shit, we were like, okay.
Yeah, sure. Like, let's slip this in now.
Mm-hmm. I think the Pentagon is referring to them as UFOs are now unidentified aerial phenomenon.
Yeah. UAPs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Cool.
Less catchy acronym. Trey cool.
Sure.
We'll adapt, I'm sure. We always do. But so yeah, there's this conspiracy theory element where what's interesting with the docuseries is that it seems to either be predicated on kind of this conspiracy theory attitude and really leaning into that idea that this is all very hypothetical, that this is all like people speculating, or it's talked about as like straight fact, which is a very interesting juxtaposition as a viewer. Hmm. I don't know. I like experiencing that was a little trippy because I was watching. So I'll just go down the list. I watched the J.J. Abrams docuseries on HBO called UFOs. Or maybe it's Amazon. Let me check real quick. J.J. Abrams.
I didn't know he was out here doing that.
I know.
J.J. What a guy.
I always think of BoJack now. I think of BoJack for everything.
I gotta rewatch that series. I think it's time.
I do it weekly. It's ridiculous.
Nice. That's like me and The Sopranos.
So
Funny. I love that that is yours.
That's so mine. I'm constantly just like, oh. I've started saying Gabagool. That. I've started literally, like, if someone will say something, like, outrageous, I'm like, oh! And then it's like, you're not from New Jersey. You're not an Italian man. Stop it.
What part of the boot are you from?
So, okay, so the UFO is on Amazon and Hulu.
Sick.
So you can watch it multiple places. But great. That cool. is a four-part docuseries, limited docuseries, by J.J. Abrams and Glenn Zipper. And it's about aliens.
That's awesome.
For that one, I will say, I'm kind of like jumping all over the place right now. I like where that one ended because it ends on this psychiatrist, John Mack, who died in kind of like suspicious circumstances. Mm-hmm. Another overlap with conspiracy theories, there's a lot of famous deaths that have been associated through these documentaries with aliens. So John Kennedy, JFK, Marilyn Monroe, both of their deaths have been conflated with this interesting whole conspiracy. And whoa. Then they were given information and not able to hold it in, and so then killed for that reason. Marilyn first, then JFK later.
Damn.
Yes. So, yeah, there's just a lot going on when we get to aliens. Yeah. Because this, like, I haven't even gotten to the actual monster yet, like, in talking about fears. And so it's just, it's a very layered fear system, I guess I would say.
Yeah, because there's this notion that the aliens are a real phenomenon, that there's powers above the general population that are keeping information from us.
And then couple that with the fear that there are aliens and that our government is keeping information about them from us.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. There's these layers of things being kept from us, and who is doing the keeping
and
of the secrets.
To what end?
Yes, because if the aliens are doing it, obviously we can infer that's for their own safety, yada, yada, yada. If our government is doing it, for why and all of the, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
because we can't handle it, because it will affect, you know, the economics of our world, because, like, there's all of these different things.
Yeah.
And so then that's, again, where conspiracies abound, because there's so many directions you can go. And so that's just why this gets so fascinating and honestly terrifying, because another aspect that these docuseries introduced was that because there is this layer of secrecy that could have to do with the government, there's also the possibility that if there is a corruption, like if there is if there is something that occurs with all of this, we won't know if it's actual extraterrestrials or if it's our government trying to stage something in order to meet a certain end. Because if again, this is all coming from these documentaries, this is not coming from my brain, but like, if the government is trying to hide the existence, the known existence of extraterrestrials, then that would be as a means of control. And so then that could still be something they would continue into trying to control the outcome by, like, let's say there's no real evidence that these beings are confrontational or like want any sort of war with us, but, you know, humans want a war.
Well, there's
they could spin it.
I was just reminded of the really popular conspiracy theory that in the 1950s, President Eisenhower had some fucking collusion with the Greys, where they came up with some kind of agreement. Like,
this conspiracy is alive and well. The most recent season of American Horror Story is literally based on this.
I keep seeing the previews for that on Hulu. I'm like, I don't want to watch that.
I didn't get into American Horror Story for the first decade of its existence. And then I binged it like 2 years ago and I watched all of it. And so now I've caught up with the most recent season. And
why is that clown making out with that alien? Is it a clown?
I think that's just advertising. Oh. I know what you're talking about. It's like the little thumbnail for the show. And there's no clown.
Oh.
The clown, I think, is an old character.
My brain made it into a clown.
No, you're right.
Oh, really?
I'm saying in the actual season right now, there's no actual clown. Because
I keep seeing it on Hulu. And I'm like, what is that?
That's the thumbnail. You're not wrong. It's just misleading. Oh, my
goodness. Okay.
No, listen. And that's... Okay, so that's another thing. So the Grays, this whole idea of... Ooh. We talked about it at the very beginning of the episode, but like the visual of aliens that we have and how that feels so fucking random, because how would we know? But yet we all kind of have this general visual of aliens. They've got big eyes. They've got like a
big head,
big head, but almost like a heart shaped head. No earlobes, like maybe cavities for the ears, the nose.
Yeah.
And communicate telepathically. They're like in accounts of alien interactions, abduction, all this stuff. There are like people who actually describe them this way, and like a lot of accounts. And that's the trippy part, is like I always assumed that our visual of aliens came from Hollywood. And no, Hollywood has completely like done their research, quite frankly, in terms of using what is out there in terms of people like saying they've had encounters.
Sure.
For all of this stuff, like 3 feet tall, human shaped, but 4 fingers, big head. Like a lot of the descriptions match the visuals that we have come to know.
Yeah. It's super scary to think about. So like this idea of like archetypes, like Jungian, like collective unconscious type of monsters that like these like things that harken back to our reptilian brains that we're like afraid of, which is like, you know, people bring it up when they talk about things like the Slender Man or these like figures that are like very scary to us, or like how a lot of people who have sleep paralysis will see like a man with like a top hat. It's like, why is he wearing a hat? You know, like these like things. And the alien, the figure of the humanoid alien with the bulbous head, small body, is like one of these archetypal collective unconscious like figures that it's something is deeply buried. Yeah.
And it was weirdly drawn, because I think I've always been able to kind of assuage my fear of aliens as something that is very fictionalized. And so actually spending time with people's accounts, and like, it is not. It is a collective gathering of, you know, information, whether we believe that's real information or imagined, you know, that's beside the point. This is not coming, this is not being implanted in us from imaginary places. This is retellings that have come together again and again.
Yeah.
And there are people who talk about this like it's just straight fact. And so like, whether you believe it or not, that is just compelling. Like, I'm sorry. It just is.
And it's like, it really makes me feel like something happened. Yes. You know?
Yes. And so just to, like, to bring it back to art and art history a little bit, because honestly, I wasn't sure I could. Like, I was kind of like, this might just go out there.
I was curious.
We might just like end our episode like way out here, and like, that's fine.
Machu Picchu.
No, but really, like, okay, so the amount of things that we talk about in art history that have been connected back to aliens is very interesting, because it's not fact-based, like this is all speculation, but like that's a lot of what art history is. So let's go.
Yeah.
Okay, so my favorites. The Ark of the Covenant.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Big one in Ancient Aliens. So they are likening the Ark of the Covenant, which is an ancient biblical item. Like, it was crafted by the Israelites for God, mm-hmm. and it was meant to house God on earth. So yeah. a material object meant to be like the dwelling place of God on earth.
Yeah.
Mobile. It was like a 3x5 foot box, basically. If you're an art history person, I guarantee you've seen depictions of it being carried on like 4 sticks by like men on their shoulders. Mm-hmm. The Israelites carry this around through the desert. Very prized possession. So in Ancient Aliens, this becomes a nuclear device.
Oh.
Ah, yes.
Which, again, fascinating, because a lot of the things that it's described as doing can be explained by
yeah.
symptoms of nuclear radiation.
Interesting.
And it just kind of fits into that idea of like, more often than not, things are kind of like the more simple answer. And it's very interesting to think of these things that were at one point explained as spiritual, like religious events,
mm-hmm.
could be explained in things that we understand now in scientific terms.
Right.
And this is where it gets tricky in terms of like the idea of period eye versus yes. like contemporary yes. is you don't want to be disrespectful or dismiss things because of what we know now. But also, what if we could explain things based on what we know now?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I understand a lot of the harsh criticisms of shows like Ancient Aliens.
Totally.
Like, well, valid. You know, just because white people didn't make it doesn't mean it was aliens. However, there are some really interesting and compelling
yeah.
arguments to be made that there maybe was some kind of visitation.
Mm.
I don't know.
It's interesting. And like, again, we don't have answers, nor do we have the time to even like go there. But if you're interested in this at all, check out this show. Season 6. I think it's like
it.
Episode
2. We should
2.
Watch it tonight, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to get scared.
A few episodes later, they hit Mount Shasta, which I like definitely
oh,
to talk
the Lemurians.
About.
That's like, yeah.
But they didn't get to the Lemurians.
How the fuck did they
Thank
not talk
you.
About them?
That's what I'm saying. I got so excited. Literally,
Fools.
I was fist
Fools.
Pumping in my house
gonna
alone
write
at night
an IMDb
when they started talking
review.
About Mount Shasta. And then they never brought up the Lemurians. And I was like, well,
that's
okay.
Fucked up. That's a mistake.
Missed opportunity. But, okay, so Ark of the Covenant, good one. And I didn't get into like all the details, but basically, yeah, symptoms of radiation. So like people dying early, like cataracts, like radiation. Poisoning,
sure.
Basically, they're describing.
Right.
It's all on there on Ancient Aliens. Another one. This one was the J.J. Abrams UFO docuseries. St. Teresa.
Ooh. Over here, have an ecstasy.
Described it as an alien encounter and
Word.
Described the
mm-hmm.
the angel as an extraterrestrial being.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was like, interesting.
That is interesting.
Again, like, who's to say? It's not right. that we're sitting here saying that that is the more obvious explanation. They're both potentials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But mm-hmm. I was just like, oh, we brought her into this.
You know, yeah, this idea of like angels being aliens, it's the same idea behind the Anunnaki of the Babylonians and the Sumerians and everything, as being these like creator gods that were aliens essentially,
yeah,
that
right.
just brought information, which sort of birthed this first like complex civilization, you know, first being debatable, but anyway.
But I also, yeah. like, I guess where I'm kind of, like, really into this idea is because what is the difference between deciding that early civilizations were influenced by gods or extraterrestrial beings?
Yeah.
Which is what this kind of comes down to a
yeah.
lot. Like, there was an episode
yeah.
that was also about ancient Olympians and, like, Mount
sure.
Olympus.
Sure.
And,
sure.
yeah, the clouds and the lightning and all of that being aliens up in the mountains, because that was like the best place to be. So I don't know. It's just,
it's, I think it's real.
It's very interesting. And as corny as it is, like Marvel's version of Thor as like, that like the
Hollywood
Norse
does their research. This is what I'm learning and giving, like, this is where I want all the credit to go to.
Yeah.
So what does Thor say?
But like, just what does Thor say? But just in terms of conceptualizing like Norse gods as actually being extraterrestrial, like an extraterrestrial civilization, I think is very interesting.
Yes. Boom. See,
just to think about it. It's interesting to think about.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And then it kind of like, I touched on this at the very beginning, but it gets into like psychology a little bit. And there's, you know, the major period of UFO sightings, alien abduction stories is kind of like the 50s is when that like started, a little earlier maybe. So there's a lot of talk about this in terms of trauma, and like all of this, people just having abnormal or less than common reactions to traumatic events, to things happening. But it's also so interesting. And we know at this point that like there's so many universes and things out there that the possibility of us being the only living things is just so small. But yeah, coming back to visuals and visual representation, more often than not they're similar to us. From time to time I think we see things more imaginative, like Star Wars gets into some like crazier looking aliens that look nothing like us.
Sure.
Rick and Morty also does a great job.
Love that show.
Making all sorts of different extraterrestrial, multidimensional creatures, which is super fun. And I just like that. That's, I think, where I get excited is, regardless of what we actually can confirm, just talking about like the possibilities of all of this and what it could mean. And yeah,
I feel like in our lifetimes, we are going to end up getting some hard confirmation on something to do with this, because there's also the theory that what we perceive as extraterrestrials could be intradimensional, which is actually thought to be more likely, just considering how vast space is and like how it would just take so long for some extraterrestrial civilization to make contact with us, or that what we perceive as extraterrestrials could be like robots, like artificial intelligences. And which is, you know, pretty, I'm afraid of AI. That shit freaks me out.
There's a lot, and again, a lot of fear wrapped up in this. Like, a big fear that comes up with aliens is the idea of humans being abducted and impregnated.
Oh, Lord.
Like, that's a recurring fear.
Or just having stuff done to us.
Yeah, it comes up again in...
Don't probe me, bro.
Probe.
I don't want to be probed.
Yourself. Don't do it, please.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's interesting. Watch this most recent season of American Horror Story.
I guess I'll watch it. I just thought it had to do with a clown and an alien. And I was like, that looks stupid. I don't want to watch that.
Yeah. No, I like this show. And to be honest, like, they get a little corny sometimes, which can like irk me at moments. But they do generally do their research pretty well. So like, they lean into the corny horror like aspect of not, I don't know, just not always making like the best jokes and stuff, but in terms of the information they're bringing forth, like, they do their freaking homework. They connect the dots. They make it interesting.
And watch Ancient Aliens if you're out here.
We're gonna watch it tonight.
Be critical, but watch Ancient Aliens.
Yeah, it's just good entertaining television. And sometimes they make really good, like, sometimes they have some legitimate ass like scholars and scientists and stuff on there, and it's really interesting stuff.
What's the quote? Oh my god, we almost made it without.
Ancient astronaut theorists say that
Machu Picchu.
Astronaut theorists.
And then, like, they don't answer the question. Like, no. They're just, like, go on to the next
thing.
Their
legal,
like,
team does half the writing sure. of that show.
I just love that term, ancient astronaut theorist.
Like, me too.
I want to be one.
1,000 times in the last 48 hours.
God.
That's all I've been watching.
Good on you. And I got to watch that J.J. Abrams.
Same.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Aliens. So scary. I would say that of all the monsters that we've talked about today and that I've just have been privy to in being alive. I don't know why that came out so weird. But
I liked it. I like it.
Aliens, extraterrestrials are the scariest to me. Just because it's the fear of obviously the unknown, but the fear is also that there's some sort of like advanced civilization that's going to come to us that are going to be, that are leaps and bounds beyond anything we can comprehend as far as technology goes. And, you know, hearing people like Stephen Hawking, who used to say that, like, if, you know, he was really against like SETI, like the sending the signals out into space, trying to see if anyone would contact us, because he said, if there's a society of extraterrestrials that have mastered space travel, they have done so with the intention of looking for other homes to inhabit, resources.
So this is where it gets super interesting too, because this is where, like, okay, so the idea that no matter what, if, like, okay, so even if we all agree that there are extraterrestrials and, like, that is a given, we're cool with that understanding, their motives are not necessarily going to be clear to us, because even if they are not confrontational motives, it is within the interest of our governments to make us think that they are. So that's why there's like this conspiracy theory that even that if there is some potential attack, that it could be real or not real, because it's in the interest of our government to make us think that alien intruders are an enemy.
Mm-hmm. What would be the interest? It seems like it would just cause a lot of shenanigans.
Just like a common enemy, like uniting under a common enemy.
Yeah, that's the plot of Watchmen.
It's a plot of like every fucking movie that has to do with aliens, unfortunately. Like that's the thing, is it brings us together because now we have a common enemy.
Or, well, not Watchmen the movie, but Watchmen the graphic novel, because the movie fucks up that ending and I will never watch it again.
Okay, yeah.
Period.
Sure.
Banned.
That's fair.
Anyway, super scary, and hope that they do come in peace, but more than likely we would be like bugs to them that they just want to squash so they can harvest our resources.
I don't know. Or steal our sun. Like, some of these documentaries, it's funny, spheres. Like you can feel the way they kind of want to persuade you. And some make it seem like that they really are chill as fuck and that they have no interest in that, like
I hope we're like a zoo to them.
Well, that's the thing, it's like we are so low technologically compared to them that they have no interest in like fucking
doing
with
anything.
Us there were some people trying to make it sound like they're mostly concerned with what we're doing and our violent nature.
I've heard,
especially like, because we've like thrown nuclear bombs up into the atmosphere and stuff, and apparently there have been like responses to that in ways that have made people like be like, oh, interesting. Wonder. Like, what does that mean? And potentially it means that aliens are like, dude, stop like
it.
Especially if we do live in like a multi-dimensional
universe
where like that be fucking up a whole nother reality in like a very real way, and we're just like what does that do.
Everyone should go back and listen to The End of the World with Josh Clark. He talks a lot about like extraterrestrials being an existential threat, and I was scared. I was at work, not doing work and listening to.
But then also question that fear, because are we being controlled by being made to fear something?
Natalie's been indoctrinated.
Can
she watched 48 hours of alien documentaries and she is now indoctrinated. It's all a big
team
ruse.
Alien. Get out.
All right.
Well,
Ginny's like,
you know,
we done.
There's a lot of food for thought here.
Yeah.
And I think if it were me and if I had to choose one creature that we discuss in this episode to encounter, I think it'd
vampire.
Be the, well, not necessarily that, but I would, I'd be like, all right, you know, tell me your stories in exchange for a small vial of blood, just a small one.
I would definitely want to encounter the vampire. The zombie's just gross.
Too gross.
Yeah. I don't, and where are you
the alien
get,
is too
like,
real.
They're not
yeah, exactly. The zombie's gross. I don't want to be eaten. Mm. The alien is going to put something in my butt and I don't want that.
Yeah.
And
no probes.
The vampire might put something in my butt, but at least it'll be fun. Anyway, cut that out. Well, I hope that everyone has enjoyed this episode about our just random ass monsters,
you know,
that we've been thinking about.
Creatures of imagination, things. Nightmare, fantasies, all of the above.
We hope you're enjoying your spooky season. We hope that you have a safe time out there. Everybody, you know, take it easy.
Take it easy.
we prescribe it.
Yeah. Well, we love you.
We love you.
We love you.
Till next time.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
The art history base.
Anyway.
That in mic.
Oh my god.
Oh my god.
Well, she doesn't listen to our podcast, so it wouldn't matter.
Nah. Okay.
Nah.
Na 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 na. So.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.